that when they experience stress, I mean, more like chronic stress or like high levels of stress, they start feeling symptoms in their body. And usually it's those first signs and symptoms that start to come through that warn us the system's overloaded or is not coping with the stresses we're going through. It's really simple. We come back to some basic understandings of the central nervous system, in particular what happens when we go from intersympathetic nervous system arousal, which is our fight or flight response in the body. When that happens, your body is primed to deal with threats, you know, and our mind does not differentiate a real physical threat from a mental threat. It's the same thing. It's the same response that happens in our body. So we have our resources heading into the extremes of our body. We're getting tense and tight and ready to deal with whatever that threat is, to attack it or to run away from it. Although we also have responses where we might just simply freeze. And, you know, you're talking before about the mind getting overloaded with lots and lots of pressures building up. In our mind, we can actually overload our nervous system to the point where it goes into shutdown mode or even freeze mode. So when the sympathetic nervous system is activated, that's our stress response. It's our body trying to help us deal with a situation, but we're not biologically designed for that to be constantly on, constantly triggered, wearing us down, and it does. If it's constantly activated or frequently activated, then the body starts to have an effect of that from what is going on within the system directly. So when we have that going on, we do have a wearing down of the system, and we do have an increased susceptibility to things happening. Now, that could be from a genetic perspective or epigenetics, where we have certain genes switched on, certain disease genes switched on because of all that sympathetic arousal. And that's where we become susceptible to things, you know, starting to break down and different conditions coming on. I mentioned cardiovascular disease and diabetes is two very common ones that are pinpointed, but from my own experience, it was an autoimmune condition.
The question we'll speak of before is, what is the mind-body connection and what are some of the misconceptions around the general topic of mind-body?
Absolutely. Look, I think the concept of the mind-body connection has been pretty controversial for many centuries. And now, at least here in the 21st century, we have a general understanding that the mind and body are connected to one another, or that our mental and physical health have a relationship and influence to one another. And I think that the difficulty has been for a lot of people is, one, we're not really taught much about this at school. It's not a conversation that really happens from early on in life. And a lot of people go through life not really considering that their mind and what happens in their mental space has an influence on their physical health or their physical reality, and that what happens in their physical reality then affects their mental space. So I think for a lot of people, it's even just having a conversation about how the mind and body connected is unusual. And so it would be very easy for a lot of people to not even consider what that means and what the impact is for their lives, their health and their well-being. So I think misconception is that it matters, which it absolutely does. And there's definitely misconceptions that have gone back for many generations about the fact that the mind and the body are one or two flip sides of the same coin, whereas for a long time, the mind was not really considered as influential or a part of physical health. And this has certainly influenced Western medicine very, very heavily up until, you know, even just the last couple of decades. So, yeah, I think it's really interesting just to have the opportunity to start talking about it and educating people more on it.
Yeah, I think that what's happened over the decades, and I'm only 30, so haven't been around that long, but what I've seen is that from my point of view, when it comes to health, there's an isolation point of view, which is, or isolationistic point of view, which is you have the heart, you have the liver, you have a specialist for this, specialist for that. And from my experience of going through health challenges in the past, the biggest challenge I faced, you know, when you're in that kind of chronic health space, as far as when you're experiencing that, it's very frustrating when you're going to one person, they're saying one thing, and then the next person is saying another thing, next person is saying another thing, and you're going down this kind of the medical merry-go-round, I'd call it, where you're just going around and around and around with all these different specialists, and I feel like sometimes there isn't a holistic point of view. Would you say that the mind-body connection is down the avenue of being able to identify that the body works as an ecosystem as opposed to individualized parts? And if so, what are the applications of that, maybe with stress to start with?
Yeah, I think that's an excellent point, Luke. Having myself been down at the merry-go-round with chronic health issue with autoimmunity and finding that exact same experience of being treated for parts rather than the whole, I think there are going to be many people who relate to that. I think in the journey, when it comes to starting to think about this interrelationship from a holistic perspective, I think stress is a great starting point, because people would know generally from their own experiences that when they experience stress, I mean, more like chronic stress or like high levels of stress, they start feeling symptoms in their body. And usually it's those first signs and symptoms that start to come through that warn us the system's overloaded or is not coping with the stresses we're going through. So whether that is sleep starts to fall down, or we start getting more aches and pains in the body, the digestive system's not happy, we're experiencing different symptoms there, or even having other ways that our thinking is not going so well, or we're finding that we're getting other breakouts of our skin and different things going on. That's a relationship from a mental source. Stress is something that's produced in the mind, so it has an effect on the body. In the same way, if we're experiencing stress long-term, there is like very well-known pathways that lead to then illness developing, more chronic or serious illnesses, you know, cardiovascular disease, diabetes. These are we become more susceptible to them when we have long periods of stress. And again, stress is a mental thing. It's something that happens in the mind and affects the body. But it's also the other way around too. If you've got stuff going on with your physical health, and you would know this from your own experience, Luke, it's stressful on the mind. You're worrying about it. You're thinking about what's going to happen in the future. You're trying to cope with pain or suffering or symptoms that are affecting your life. So it also then affects your mental health. It's such a two-way relationship. And I don't think it's talked about nearly enough. I don't know very many people who have their doctor, their GP, their specialist ask them many questions about what's happening in their mental space. So, you know, we're still in the early stages of really this whole area getting opened up and considered.
And so when it comes to stress, let's use that as the example, because I think that first and foremost, a lot of people would be experiencing it, but two, it also is so relevant for the body. What is happening in the body when stress is occurring? And it could be, I think that there's two ways to see stress as far as I'm concerned, which is stress first and foremost, as in a more blanket statement, like there's stress on the body. It could be physical, it could be positive stress. I think it's called EU stress or EU something or other stress. And that's, you know, where you're exposing yourself to stressful situations intentionally with a positive end outcome. You have kind of the blanket term of stress, you know, across the whole body. Then you have specific stress, which I think is the more cultural way of using it, which is I've been working really hard, or I've been, you know, I've got my kids screaming in the background, I've got work here, I've got this thing to do and that thing to do. I just feel so overwhelmed. So I guess just on that, the latter, on that one around stress that people experience when it comes to their life and all the different things they have to do, what is actually happening in the body and in the mind and the body when it comes to stress, and how can that manifest over time to more chronic illnesses and chronic conditions?
Look, I think it's really simple. We come back to some basic understanding of the central nervous system, in particular what happens when we go from intersympathetic nervous system arousal, which is our fight or flight response in the body. When that happens, your body is primed to deal with threats. You know, and our mind does not differentiate a real physical threat from a mental threat. It's the same thing. It's the same response that happens in our body. So we have our resources heading into the extremes of our body. We're getting tense and tight and ready to deal with whatever that threat is, to attack it or to run away from it. Although we also have responses where we might just simply freeze. And, you know, you're talking before about the mind getting overloaded with lots and lots of pressures building up. In our mind, we can actually overload our nervous system to the point where it goes into shutdown mode or even freeze mode. So when the sympathetic nervous system is activated, that's our stress response. It's our body trying to help us deal with a situation, but we're not biologically designed for that to be constantly on, constantly triggered, wearing us down, and it does. If it's constantly activated or frequently activated, then the body starts to have an effect of that from what is going on within the system directly. So when we have that going on, we do have a wearing down of the system, and we do have an increased susceptibility to things happening. Now, that could be from a genetic perspective or epigenetics, where we have certain genes switched on, certain disease genes switched on because of all that sympathetic arousal. And that's where we become susceptible to things, you know, starting to break down and different conditions coming on. I mentioned cardiovascular disease and diabetes as two very common ones that are pinpointed. But from my own experience, it was an autoimmune condition. I had a susceptibility to thyroid disease from my family. And I was only like 21 years old, 22 years old, when an overload of stress, which ironically came from studying psychology and trying to get through a massive honours project, which has some really interesting insights that's come out of it and has actually led to me being interested in mind-body medicine. But that triggered my autoimmune disease. High levels of stress, intense over a long period. There's all sorts of things can get activated because of it.
Can we, if you're comfortable, would you mind sharing a bit more about the journey of that and autoimmune?
Yeah, absolutely. Look, when I first started noticing symptoms, it was a few months after I'd gone through my most intense period of doing all this study. And I also had a massive letdown. I had a direction in life. I was just wanting to become a psychologist, and I'd just completed my honours in the hope that would get me into a master's program. And I actually didn't get in to the master's programs that I applied for. I didn't have a plan B, and I felt very lost. I didn't know what to do with myself. Then I started noticing these symptoms creeping on. I found that my legs were getting really painful. I didn't know why. I had problems with my skin starting to develop. I was gaining weight without explanation. I had hair falling out, brain fog. You know, anyone who understands thyroid disease or Hashimoto's, which is what I was eventually diagnosed with, I had all the classic symptoms at the extreme end. And I had doctors look at one symptom, another symptom, a physiotherapist trying to help, etc. But no one piecing the whole lot together until finally I got blood work done that revealed that this autoimmunity was there. And from my experience of getting a diagnosis, that was a relief, and it is a relief for a lot of people just to have an understanding or an explanation for what might be going on in the body. So that's a starting point. But then the journey of using Western medicine, starting on medication, okay, that started to help things. There was improvement in certain symptoms. I could walk again. My hair was growing back. My skin was better. My head started to clear. But I still had a lot of residual symptoms, which I was not content to just live with. You know, when you're a young 20-something, you don't want to be like feeling cold all the time or having difficulty losing weight or, you know, feeling like you just weren't working properly. You know, things just not quite right. And that actually started me on a journey on exploring complementary and alternative medicines and trying different things and getting new insights and new changes with each practitioner, with each modality I tried. And that's eventually how I came to understand a bit more about how old Eastern philosophies of traditions where mind-body connection was just a part of treating people as a whole started to come back in, came in for me. And I went, okay, well, there's something about looking at things holistically and treating systems beyond just being a biomedical machine, a body walking around that's just a bunch of, you know, chemicals interacting with one another that's relevant. So it's the journey with autoimmune disease is the only reason that I've really been into a whole bunch of extra areas of healing and health, which I would never have had the chance to do, and has probably helped me as a practitioner help people understand that there's so many other choices and pathways towards healing and health.
So let's go back to when that was happening, right? So you're 22, and you mentioned there you're going through all these different symptoms and you then started medication. So let's go from that point. You started taking medication, you then still had symptoms, and I can relate to this, by the way, because I had very similar things, except with no diagnosis. But there's this weird feeling in my body, which we can go into on that. So you had medication, and then, so run me through the journey of going from medication to then going to this Eastern philosophy, you know, holistic approach. What was the aha moment? What was the transition of like, something's going to change? Or what was that moment for you? Run us through that and what happened from there.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. When you start going on a journey of exploration to find solutions, you find some people who are really supportive and give you ideas, and other people who are really skeptical and want to shut that journey down. So you have to pursue it in spite of obstacles and people who are naysayers. You've got to find your formula that's right for you. And I think that in the early stages, I was exploring things like homeopathy and naturopathy, traditional Chinese medicine, and Ayurveda, traditional Indian medicine. And each of those had such a different way of considering the body as a system. And I was loving now having this conversation about, well, what was happening for you at the time in your life when things started to change for you? Like, what was happening? What was the journey? What was the stress? What was the significant change? So while the body was starting to improve with these different modalities starting to help, it was actually really interesting because there was a juncture I mentioned not feeling lost after not getting into my master's program. And I ended up studying coaching, life coaching, and started working as a life coach. Through that journey, I got introduced to neuro-linguistic programming. And in my journey of studying NLP, the particular amazing teachers that I studied with, they were interested in mind-body medicine. And they had a whole section about health and healing that was such a paradigm shift, again, in a different direction, considering, well, what are your beliefs? What are your traumas? You know, what have you been through that has overwhelmed your system emotionally or psychologically? And in what way does that need to be healed and resolved for the body to then go in a state of healing? That was mind-blowing for me. I absolutely credit them so much for setting me on a journey of considering what I need to do to make change to myself up here, down, and not just the body on its own.
Wow, okay then. So you're a psychologist. You have a degree in psychology.
Yeah.
So what parts of, and this is not to belittle or, you know, say psychology is less than what it is or more than what it is or whatever. So why wasn't that enough? Why wasn't that enough for you to address these issues? You mentioned a lot about what I would perceive to be as the way you view things, the way you understand reality and patterns, and trauma can be a part of psychology, but why wasn't psychology enough to work through these things? Or was it enough and I'm just not realizing that?
Look, so first of all, my area of specialty in psychology is health psychology. So I managed to come back and get into a master's program after working as a coach and using NLP and other techniques to help people improve their lives. And I went to the University of Adelaide who offers this health master's program. And it's really interesting because health psychology is not something that's often discussed in the field of psychology. It's a specialist area. It's an endorsed area of practice. It is the one particular discipline that focuses on that mind-body connection more specifically and understanding the journey that we go through in our physical health and our mental health as side by side. So the biopsychosocial model of health, which is something that is completely assumed in health psychology and has been something that has gradually become more normalized or accepted across general psychology, medicine, and all sorts of different allied health, you know, areas, that our biology, our psychology, and our social worlds all interact and meld. So I think that coming into the health psychology world was helpful to be able to say, I've had all these other experiences personally. I've been able to work in different ways, supporting people with their mind, body, health for years. Now I've got this additional qualification that enables me to leverage those skills to a new level to be able to help people and support them and be more accepted in general. So I guess I'm talking from my particular field of psychology rather than psychology as a whole, which is actually a very broad practice or set of disciplines in one. I think it's wonderful that as a health psychologist, I'm privy to be able to talk to people about the range of options that they have to them, that it's kind of my duty to help them understand that if they're not getting results or success with just one area, what else could we try? What else have you tried? Let's look at health from a bigger picture perspective and work on it holistically. And that really, for me, I've been always interested in integrative medicine as a model and functional medicine, which is not so big here in Australia, but bigger in the US and other countries, where we absolutely see all practitioners with different specialties appreciate one another's work and want to collaborate and integrate modalities into one. And I think it's great because as a health psychologist, I can be across that for people.
And I want to touch on that. I want to go through health psychology and what that looks like. So just back to the journey of yourself there, if you don't mind going a bit further into that. So you then discover these different modalities, these different ways of being, I would call it. And so what, like, run me through the practical steps that you took. Like, were you, so you were on the medication and then you, did you stop? Did you wean off it slowly? Did you start doing ice baths? Like, run us through the kind of journey and the specific things that you did that, so people can relate to the story, because I'm sure there's people listening right now, and myself, I'm also very interested in this as well because of my own journey. But just tell us, like, the steps that you took from, you know, having this autoimmune disease. Is it, have you gone into remission now, or like, is it gone, or like, what's the, where are you at now, and kind of what was the journey to that as far as the healing steps, so to speak?
Yeah. So before I go into this, I will just say healing is something that's individual to the person. So I'm going to separate healing from being cured because I think they're two separate things. So in my journey of trying different modalities, you know, let's say, for example, I tried homeopathy. Homeopathy gave me greater temperature regulation back. There was something about that that kicked the body into being able to regulate its temperature better. Naturopathy gave me insights into what I needed to bring into my body, supplementation, the building blocks, so that my body had a greater chance to be able to do what it needed to do naturally. Eventually, after varying things I tried and experienced, I got to a point where I'd learned enough about mind-body medicine, and I think just in general, the varying lifestyle factors that we kind of need to get in a pretty good balance in order for our bodies to be in the right environment to heal and be well. So I launched into what I called a self-healing quest. And I made a choice to do a combination of certain things and work towards weaning off medication just to see what happened. I was super curious about the journey. So I just made sure I was exercising well. I had a great personal trainer, and we were doing the right things to have the body in the best shape and form it could be, getting my sleep right, my nutrition, my supplementation right. Now, these weren't completely new to me. I was already doing a lot of these things, but in a very purposeful way. And then it's like, all right, well, what am I doing up here? What am I doing to shift and change perhaps some of the catalyzing or causing factors that set this whole thing in motion from the beginning? So I did some work with that with different practitioners that helped me go back to in kind of whether forms of regressive therapy or different ways in which I was able to sort of work through the emotions and the shock I'd been through and the varying ways that I had to change my identity and how I saw myself. That was really important. And then to keep myself in a good mental space, making choices every day to practice mind-body medicines or modalities that allowed me to be in the best space I could possibly be. So then I weaned off medication. I came off medication and I was feeling perfectly fine, perfectly normal, actually really, really well. Then this was a opportunity after being off medication. I think I'd been off it for about 12 months in total by the time that I had gone to go get some bloods done. And it's kind of a funny story, Luke. I'd gone to my doctor and I'd got my blood script sorted out, and I'd gone and then had my bloods taken, and I'd gone back to work. And later the same day, I had a phone call, or actually it was a missed call from the doctor's office saying, "Oh my God, you must get to the hospital straight away." I'm like, "What? I've just worked a full day. I'm feeling great. What are you talking about?" And I called the practice back, and they said, "Look, you know, we've got your blood results. I can't tell you over the phone what the results are, but you know, we would advise you to go to the hospital." You know, I was like, okay, well, I feel perfectly fine. And they said, well, we'll come in and see the doctor in a couple of days, but, you know, this is our advice to give you. I called my naturopath. I said, look, obviously whatever's in those results show that I'm in a hypothyroid state and so severe that they think that I should go to hospital. What's your advice? Naturopath said, well, how do you feel? I said, perfectly fine. And they said, what are they going to do? Give you some thyroxine? You know, how long does it take for that to get up to enough of a level for you to then be able to be in normal ranges if that's their fear? Just, you know, make your own decision and go from there. So I got my bloods, and it was really interesting because when I first got diagnosed when I was 22, my TSH was over 300, crazy levels of TSH, and, you know, there was almost no thyroid hormone whatsoever in my system. Same picture again at that point. but completely different.
Can you just define TSH, sorry, quickly?
The thyroid stimulating hormone. So when that's elevated, or I couldn't even tell you what the normal range has got to be because I don't know if I've ever really experienced that in all my years of being tested. But, you know, if it's over like 5 or something like that, forgive me for those who know this better than me who are watching, but over 300 is ridiculous, right? I had one endocrinologist say I'd never seen anything like it. It's just stupid high. That's the body desperately struggling, trying to make thyroid hormone and getting nowhere with it, basically. So when I had these results, it's like, okay, but I'm great. I feel well. Everything in my body is functioning well. My brain is functioning well. So how does this work? It was such a juxtaposition to that experience of when I was 22. And it was really, really useful that I got a chance to go to the Australian Integrative Medical Association had a conference that year that I was able to go to. It was not very long after I got these results. And I was in a state of confusion. Should I do something? Should I take medication again? Or should I just trust that some form of healing has happened in my system? And there's something about that I should feel excited about. I was pretty confused. And there was an expert at this conference who was specialized in the thyroid. And I told him my story. And he said, you've already got your answer. You've healed. But what you've done is something I have seen occasionally. It's like he suggested it was like a form of neuroplasticity, some way in which the body has adapted to health and well-being without the hormone in the system that it usually relies on to create those functions. It was insane. His basic advice was to me, look, you could continue perfectly fine on your own as it is. You don't have to take medication again. The only advice he said is if you got pregnant, then those hormones would be important for the baby. And that's where I had a little conundrum. I had to consider whether I might start taking something. And I did eventually choose to take a natural version of the synthetic one that more normally people take when they've got thyroid disease. So I've been taking a low dose of the porcine or the desiccated thyroid supplement, which is something you can get through an integrative doctor and is compounded. And it's really natural and it feels good. And it just gives me the reassurance that, you know, if I got pregnant, I'd be doing myself and the baby justice. So that's the journey that I've been on, Luke.
Very fascinating. So a bit about my journey, if you don't mind. I mind me sharing. So I went through a whole journey of, gosh, like I was going out and partying and drinking and doing what I thought most teenagers and people in their early 20s do in Australia, especially with our culture. I think it's changing now a lot, but, you know, back then it was very heavy into drinking and partying and doing those things. And I'd always had this, it's a combination of things, right? I think this is a very important thing to share about health. When it comes to health, there's never, well, I mean, maybe there is sometimes, but for the most part, from my experience and what I've heard, speaking to people and dabbling in that kind of area of research myself, there's never, or not always, one thing that's causing the issue. It could be a combination of things. So in my case, I mean, about 2 or 3 years ago, there was a host of things going on. There was mold exposure. There was gut health issues. There's also just stress as well in the system. So low DHEA levels, for example. And those things altogether, if you have 2 or 3 of them, and some people have more than that, then you have health issues and you have chronic health issues. And then it's really difficult to, I think that if you were to think of it like a net, your genetics or your epigenetics or whatever the word you want to use is, I think genetics would be the right word in this case. The weak part of the net will always break first, and that's where the symptomology would come through and you say, well, I have this or I have that. So I had all these things going on and like just spinning out. I remember one time, actually it was Christmas, either 2021 or 2022, I think it was 2022. So about literally almost 2 years ago now on the dot. I was at my place and we're having dinner, me and some friends, and I just started spinning out. Like I was just, and this would happen all the time. I'd eat food. I just start spinning out. I just like, it was, my head was spinning. And it got to a point where it happened so much. Obviously it wasn't pleasant, but I'm like, I'm going to plan for it now. This is what's going to happen. No matter what I ate, no matter what I did. And that place had mold in it. And there was other things going on as well. So then I go to the naturopath. I go to, in the past, I'd seen people here and there to try and get my health in the best place possible. But there's never really like a clear result. Like there was just some things that would change and then, you know, was just nothing really changed, to be honest with you. So I went to this one person and we did a whole bunch of tests. We did GI mapping, we did blood work, and there was a few things that came up. And one of the things that came up was an overgrowth of bad bacteria in the stomach. Another thing was overgrowth of bacteria. What was it called? It was a bacteria that doesn't do well processing fats. There's a word for it, and I had it in my head yesterday, but I forget what it is now. Let me just give me a second to try and think of that. No, I don't have it with me. Okay, so if it comes up, I'll share it. But there's an overgrowth of this bacteria, and there was a dysbiosis, as they would call it, of good to bad bacteria in the stomach. And so I just went on this journey, like similar to what you said about this kind of this quest of healing, went through this journey. Cost me a lot of money, like supplements and consultations, and got to a place of quote unquote healing the gut to the best of the ability with what I had at the time. And the next thing that arose was, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but it was the DHEA levels in my body, which means that when it came to stress, there was little brake pad on the tire. I mean, there's enough brakes on the tire, so every time I get stressed, it'd be like scratching together because there was enough buffer there for me to deal with the stress. So when I get stressed, I just feel all these symptoms, like a sharpness in my head and like just dizzy and whatever it is, even just from like a little bit of stress. And that was kind of reality I was living for a while. And it took me about maybe 9 months of just consistently trying new things, you know, doing the basics as well, as you mentioned yourself as well. So sleeping right, meditating, you know, really just taking time to slow down and not seeing the body as some kind of machine that ought to work or ought to do what it needs to do to get things done. It's like, well, it works. So you just have to work. It's like the body always knows what is best. And sometimes that means you just have to push a bit, but end of the day is a consequence for that. And that's the journey that I went through. I was running a business at the time, and anyone that knows that runs a business, and if you have staff, you've got to deal with staff and the payments for those, and then multiple clients, projects, and all these things going on. So I had all these things going on. I was going through chronic health stuff. And the lesson was that, you know, if you feel burnt out and you're able to, you just need to stop. You just need to slow down. And so I went through this journey of just repeating this process. And up until about a year ago, I have things come up every now and then at the moment. Like I'm a little bit sick at the moment, which I think is something else going on. But long story short, there was a combination of things that were happening, and it was the basics. So what everyone tells you, like consistent sleep, having a sleep schedule, having good quality sleep, you know, eating relatively clean. And I think there's also a temptation as well, just another reflection of my journey. There's a temptation to look at the Brian Johnsons of the world. Are you familiar with Brian Johnson?
Mm-mm.
Okay, Johnson is a guy, he spends, I think, about $2 or $3 million a year on his health. And he's essentially, his goal, his only goal, or as he says himself, his only goal is to increase longevity, to live for as long as humanly possible at the expense of everything else. So that means, you know, not going out and having a bad meal, like just having the perfect diet, the perfect exercise routine, not for muscle growth, not for appearance, not for aesthetics, but just purely for health reasons and longevity reasons. And he managed to reverse his biological age. I don't know how much it is exactly, but it's something like 20 or 30 years, and he's like in his late 40s. So his heart's the health of a 18-year-old, and his other organs are just a crazy amount of health things. So you have that one side of the spectrum, which is becoming super obsessed, which I think those who have a personality type of high industriousness and high in conscientiousness, they will tend to push towards that way of being. Versus the other side, which is just kind of like, oh, whatever happens. There's something in the middle, which is like, still live your life, still have a normal life where you're enjoying things, you're doing things. There is going to be a healing stage, but you're able to have a life and enjoy things and be a human and, you know, have some bad for now and then. So it's important not to go all the way to the end. That was a huge lesson for me. So that's the journey I went through. I went through that health journey of the ups and the downs and seeing that things sometimes get worse or they get better. And then now the next stage for me is just really focusing on the next step of it, like going from feeling, you know, 7.5, 8 out of 10 healthy to like, what is that next level without having to change my lifestyle too much. And, you know, when you want and you crave healthy foods, that's when you're on your right path. That's kind of where I'm at right now, because all the foods I used to eat, all the junk foods, they don't taste as nice as they used to. And the feeling of having like a nice salad bowl with various things in it is very appealing at this point. So
that's awesome. I love that. And how wonderful that you have nurtured yourself to that point. Nutrition is a hugely important part of the journey. And I think, you know, I've certainly tried lots of different dietary protocols to support and help my thyroid and general health as well. And I think that's a really important point you make about what is it that you adjust yourself to crave. When you exercise regularly, you want to exercise. When you eat well regularly, you want to eat well. When you're getting good sleep, you want to keep that up. You enjoy those benefits and you know how good it makes you feel. In the same way, when you regularly meditate, you mentioned meditation, Luke. I'm just interested to learn a bit more about that from you, because that's a form of mind-body medicine, how important that is and what happens if you miss it. You know, I'm just curious. Can you tell me a bit more about your journey with meditation?
I would love to. So I started meditating when I was 18. It was initially because I had really bad social anxiety. And I had in my mind at that point that I wanted to go out completely sober and just walk up to people and chat with them, particularly women at that point, and just start conversations and feel comfortable doing that and confident doing that. And based on what I'd learned about the mind and the body and psychology from when I was about 14, 15, when I started reading those kind of books, the issue that I was facing was overactivity in the prefrontal cortex. That's how I'd put it. To put it in simple terms, I would overthink things and just feel rigid and awkward and then I'll get this state of frenzy, right? And what I'd learned about meditation at that point from a book by a guy who used to work at Google, he wrote a book around mindfulness and its application when it came to emotional intelligence. So I thought to myself, here's a practice that is, on one side, it's going to help to calm the mind, and on the other side, it's going to improve my social intelligence. It's a perfect thing. So I started meditating, and I went through this. It's actually quite interesting. I went through this journey of, I started to meditate, and as most people report, not most people, but a lot of people that I've spoken about meditation, I hated it. I really didn't like sitting there and just doing nothing, and I'd be fidgety, and I'd like try and grab my phone and whatever it is, and so then I started meditating and creating a practice, and it went from this practice of annoyance to a practice of something that I eventually enjoyed doing. Now, a bit of a disclaimer, it wasn't something I enjoyed doing, you know, 2 months later, 3 months later, I still hated it. And it honestly took about 4 or 5 years. And the reason it took so long is for a few reasons. I started meditating, and based on what I know now, and maybe you know more about this than I do. So one of my clients is, he's in the field of psychiatry, and I do a lot of work for him. And so I have the privilege of seeing a lot of the information about the brain and how it works. And one of the things that I saw just recently, a few days ago actually, around meditation, is when you have, I guess you could say, and this is in my own language and what I interpreted, when you have a neurotic personality and you're proclivity to hold on to certain thoughts and certain things. When I say hold on, I don't mean as in like you get like ruminate too much, or you have this perfectionistic point of view. So I had that going on for me where I would start meditating. I'd start focusing on my breath. I'd start to focus on my body. And when I do that, I feel more anxious. I'm probably not giving you the best experience of meditation, but I start to feel really anxious. I start to feel really stuck in my head, and I try and get it perfect. I'll be breathing. I just feel like tight and tight and tight. So I'd start to have a very short breath when I'm meditating. And then my breath, I think the technical term in the breathwork community would be oxygen hunger. So I have really bad oxygen hunger. Not the good type either. I just started to feel really like lightheaded. And so I started seeing someone around my breathing, and he'll put this sack on my stomach. And I have to breathe in and out very gently, to the point where I had really bad oxygen hunger. Like I just wanted to really wanted to breathe really badly through my mouth and everything. I just wanted to breathe. And he said, you're not going to die. You're going to be okay. Just keep doing that. And eventually it would turn into this feeling of bliss. And I thought there was a proper way to breathe. So I was stuck with this idea in my mind of like, they breathe this way, and this is how you breathe. You're breathing this way and that way, as opposed to just letting my body breathe. and letting the life force of who, of me, of this body, this amazing thing that I have, letting it breathe as opposed to me making it breathe. And for me, that was a huge distinction, the awareness around the breath as a tool for my own end, and the breath as something that exists outside of me and that flows through me, that life flows through me. And so that took a few years. And then so fast forward from, I think it was 2012, 2016, that's when meditation started to get really serious to me. And I had lots of experiences in the space of, gosh, what was it? Maybe a year and a half, what I would call Satori experiences. So in Zen Buddhism, they talk about Satori, which is you go through a moment of awakening. And I remember distinctively doing a Joe Dispenza meditation at the time from the book You Are the Placebo, and lying down, I'd recently moved and I was living in the Southern Shire down in Sydney, and I was laying on the mattress on the floor because I hadn't yet set up the bed frame. I was lying down and I was doing this meditation. It said that to sit up during the meditation, but I just felt called to lie down, and I did lie down. I remember lying there and my body raised, it felt like this at least, my body raised off the bed. It was like I was floating in the air, like circulating and floating in the air. Then about maybe 12 months later, I had the most profound experience. I would say one of the biggest events of my life, of my short life so far. I was on a train in Sydney and I was reading this book by Eckhart Tolle, A New Earth. And I forget the verse, but I was reading it and something just went off in my mind or went off in my body. And just this whole, the whole reality, the whole very fabric of my reality changed just in a moment. I looked up and I remember looking outside, and if anyone from Sydney, I mean anyone that catches a train in anywhere of Australia, you see like the coals next to the train, you see the rails, you see like the ugly seats and, you know, the bad paint job and, you know, the kind of thing on the train. I'm sitting there, I look up and I see outside the bits of charcoal, like they had their own life. And I see the paint on the train. It was like I was staring at the very molecules and atoms of these materials, and they were like almost dancing in a way, like almost like you're on DMT in a way. I've never done DMT before. I'm assuming it's what it's like. And I look at people around me and I see inside of people, not just good and bad, but just things were just as they're supposed to be. Nothing was in the wrong or right place. It was just existing as it is. And I lived through that for about 2 weeks. This bliss, and I'd go to work and I would sit down, and this anxiety that I would used to have, even anxiety that I didn't realize that I had, it was like I was hollow. It was like I was empty. And I was sitting there just like feeling free, completely free. And that came from meditation. That came from my journey, that spiritual journey of meditation, and going really deep down that path and listening to Alan Watts and those kind of things. And I had another experience like that, and it was also very beautiful. But since then, I've had a meditation practice. I've had maybe a few weeks here and there where I've stopped it for various reasons. And as you mentioned, like there is definitely a change. And for me, it's always been there. It's always been something that is, excuse me, as something that proves to myself. It's so fascinating. And I'm sure you can attest to this as well. It's so very fascinating when maybe you have an argument with your partner, or you, I don't know, you just have a bad day, you have a bad night of sleep, or someone does something to you that just feels long. So recently this week, I'll give you just a perfect example. I got scammed 3 times in the last 2 weeks. And I got caught into a state of hatred, of feeling resentful towards these people and what had happened. I mean, there's a whole story behind it, obviously, but started really resentful for it. And just this morning, I was stressed from that because I'm just like, I've lost all this money now. And like, you know, I'm dealing with the bank and the cards, and I'm sure, you know, you've probably been through it before. It's just this whole debacle. And so I go to bed, I didn't sleep too well, but I just hear this loop in my mind of like, yeah, this person did this, and you know, I'm gonna go to the police and do this, and I still will. And I thought about it and I'm like, you know what? I just need to meditate. I just need to stop, I need to pause. I need to just chill. So I sat down, I put a 20-minute meditation on. I was sitting outside in the veranda overlooking the mountains. I'm sitting there and I'm meditating, and each, you know, moment that goes by, every couple of minutes, I just feel like this weight goes away. Like, and it was just, it was a Sam Harris's waking up meditation. And so I just felt this weight go away. And then I still felt a bit of like residue in my body. So then I went down and I did some yoga. And after I did those two things, it was just, again, I realized, I'm like, wow, like nothing outside of me. I live in and outside of the world, meaning that I'm both the world and outside the world. I'm everything in between. But nothing outside of me can really determine who I decide to be. And I have complete autonomy over how I respond to situations. It just brought me back to that place of response and productivity rather than reaction. Now, the way that I view the situation that I had is, I feel, and this is not like a, you know, when sometimes people are compassionate, like, oh, like, I feel sorry for you. The feeling that I have now is like, wow, I genuinely feel pain for this person that had to do that. Like, maybe they're struggling financially. Maybe they've been ripped off themselves so much in life and they feel like they need to do it. And like, imagine the pain they feel from that. Imagine having to do that to someone and dealing with the cognitive dissonance of that. And just like, for me, it broke my heart. I'm still going to go to the police and do these things, but it comes from a different place, a place of, look, there's a natural balance of life. That's my belief. And there needs to be, a consequence for those things. And I need to do the right thing by the system and by what needs to happen. But at the same time, like, I don't need to have hatred towards that person. That could have been me. If I was in the wrong environment, if I was born into, a certain area, if certain things went wrong in my life, maybe that was me, So that's what meditation has done for me. That's been my meditation journey up until literally this morning, so.
Wow. That's amazing. Like, oh my goodness, thank you so much for sharing. So many layers of insight that's come over time, and, that experience that you had early on is so common with people raging against meditation because of an idealistic idea of what it's supposed to be and how you're supposed to feel and what you're supposed to achieve in your mind state. A lot of people think you're meant to have no thought, nothing. There's a whole lot of this concept of a Zen state we're supposed to achieve, and people are like, that's not accessible to me. But actually, that's not the point, is it? The point is learning progressively how to sit with yourself and what to do with your experience of your internal world, and how do you check out of, or how do you start to challenge and move through and move past the stories, the judgments, the experiences that can get stuck when we let them, or we find that we get too attached to them. Mindfulness meditation has got one of the best evidence bases of all the different forms of mind-body therapies. It can be so helpful with helping build up that sense of being able to learn to be detached or to let things pass, experiences, sensations, thoughts, feelings, they all pass. Learning to let things pass. Learning how to just simply be in the moment without feeling like we need to be entertained or distracted, that we can just have a moment of bliss, of just existing in the moment and being a consciousness sitting in a body. It's pretty amazing, but it takes practice and work to get there and learning the skills. And sometimes that's not fun. Sometimes that's quite uncomfortable for people. And human beings, we don't like being uncomfortable, so we avoid things that have got discomfort. And that's where I think being able to have an understanding there's a variety of different ways to connect your mind into your body and to learn how to be more present in the moment doesn't just have to be something like sitting still in meditation. We can move the body and be in a form of meditation or in a connection of mind and body, which is why things like yoga and qigong, tai chi, these are wonderful examples of mind-body practices where you can move your body, but your mind is super connected in, and you're being in the present moment and you're working with whatever experience is coming up, but you're letting it pass. You're letting it come and go. It's such a important journey to check out a suffering as humans.
Absolutely. And that's the defining word, suffering. And so much of what we do and the suffering, the antidote to suffering sometimes exacerbates the suffering and leads to more suffering. It's the downward spiral, the metaphor of, or the imagery of the snake eating its own tail. It's like you exacerbate the issue by taking the poison that is making the issue worse. So when it comes to, I'm looking down my phone right now, when it comes to technology, it is such an interesting thing when you wake up first thing in the morning and you just say to yourself in your mind, right, It's like a toxic relationship, and where you're like, I should go back once to this person, and then next thing you know, like, you're in this whole dynamic. Same with the phone. It's like, I'm just gonna go check my phone once. I'm just gonna quickly do this on my phone. Just gonna quickly do this email. Quickly do this. First thing in the morning, you just realize after a short while that and this is another thing from meditation that I've really learned, is listening to the small intricacies in the body. And this is not only applicable for the situation we're referring to now, but also when you're entering environments where maybe you feel to yourself, something's not quite there, something just feels a bit off. And that feeling, because you've sat in silence, you know, around 20 minutes a day or even 10 minutes a day, you start to realize the ebbs and the flows of the consciousness and the reactions to certain thoughts and certain ideas. You know, an idea comes up in your mind. It's not so much about letting the idea go, but it's like, oh, I just saw that thought go by. What is that feeling that's left behind? It's almost like when you see a plane, you see a trail behind it. It's like, what is that trail of the thought? And for me, like, the struggle was always in the morning. And even now to this day, I do the best possible to keep it in another room. But even today, like, I'm looking at my phone in the morning, and I'm like, I see myself just slowly fall into that pattern. And there's other things as well, which is like looking so close to screen first thing in the morning, your eyes are just like on that screen. I just felt it straight away. I just felt that density, that feeling of not being connected to myself, the not feeling the mind-body connection. So it might be worthwhile speaking about that if you want to expand on that and just maybe tie that into some practices that people can facilitate in or go in or do around technology as well. So if you want to expand on that, that'd be awesome if you have some ideas.
Look, I think we definitely have some many blessings that come from technology and obviously some drawbacks with our addiction to being distracted or entertained. And this is one of the things I think that people often struggle with when they have got a really strong need for being constantly entertained, is to actually do the opposite, which is do a whole lot of nothing, just sitting and being, which is actually really at the essence of what mind-body medicine is about, of actually just sitting and being and allowing the natural state of healing that starts to take over in your body when you allow it to just properly rest without stimulation and without distraction and without things that could be detrimental. We can facilitate a state of healing by activating the relaxation response. You know, we've got a lot of amazing people to thank in this space, but Herbert Benson is one of the big important figures in the field of mind-body medicine to help us understand that the opposite of the stress response is the relaxation response. When we put ourselves into a state of a parasympathetic nervous system activation, but even beyond that, something that is allowing the body to do what it does naturally to heal, when we make the choice to do that, then a whole bunch of benefits happen. There's a whole bunch of cascading effects that happen in the brain and the body as a result of choosing to put ourselves in that state. And it's super interesting because some of the more recent research has said 5 to 10 minutes a day, if you were to do that regularly, is what it takes to set the body in motion, to start turning off genes of disease, to start experiencing the healing effects that mind-body practices can have. And there's lots of different ways to do that. I highly recommend anyone who's watching this, is interested in this, go and watch the film The Connection. It's a documentary by journalist Shannon Harvey. Brilliant piece of work. She's interviewed and collated a whole bunch of the research and the key thought leaders internationally on mind-body medicine, and just talking about what kind of practices can really support people to facilitate states of healing and help themselves with their psychological health as well as their physical health. So we've talked about meditation, mindfulness practices. These are excellent choices. And again, if you're choosing 5 to 10 minutes a day as a benchmark for the regularity that's going to produce benefits, and that's pretty accessible, especially if you choose to do that to begin the day before you go on the phone, maybe even use the phone with an app you've downloaded that can help you to do those practices, absolutely beautiful. Other things that are fantastic, I mentioned yoga. Yoga is an excellent mind-body practice, and it has a really good evidence base for helping with things like chronic pain, anxiety. You know, these are things that a lot of people live with and experience. I also would say that mindfulness is particularly excellent for pain issues, chronic pain, or pain-related conditions. I had, when I did my master's degree, I was able to do a systematic review of mindfulness-based interventions for fibromyalgia, which is a chronic pain and chronic fatigue condition that has very limited options available. And mindfulness does have a significant benefit psychologically and physically, particularly in the experience of pain. It shifts the way that the brain and the body is communicating between itself around the experience of pain. So that's excellent. There's so many different practices out there. You can even look at things like hypnosis as a form of mind-body medicine, where you're in a state of relaxation and you're having suggestions or things brought in to your unconscious world, to your unconscious mind, to give it an idea of how things can be different and better. Now, that could also be a great form of mind-body practice. Biofeedback. There are varying forms of biofeedback practices where you're having real-time information about something that's happening in your body, whether it's your heart rate or something else going on with your brain. You can have EEG and other forms of feedback giving you real-time information about what's happening in your body and then making the choice to slow down your heart rate or put yourself into a certain state, mental state, and see that actually starting to be reflected, that it's a really powerful form of mind-body medicine. There's so many different ways to do a mind-body practice. I've just mentioned a few, Luke, but there's actually a pretty broad, like, even prayer. Prayer is considered a mind-body practice. I think that's really interesting. Some of the things you mentioned earlier remind me that when we talk about the mind-body connection, it's very natural then to start moving on to mind-body-spirit connection, because that's often what happens when you go on the journey of really sitting with yourself and starting to learn how to be at peace with oneself inside. You cannot help but start to have the spiritual aspect of yourself, or of life being bigger than you, or you being connected to more than just this meat puppet that we walk around in, that we're actually connected to everything. And so when we consider that prayer is a form of mind-body medicine, where you're actually just getting quiet and you're connecting into your connection with something greater than you, and you're communicating with it, you're sharing your thoughts, your feelings, your concerns, maybe expressing your gratitude. You know, you take out the God factor, that's mind-body medicine in practice. So there are so many ways people can access it. Maybe they didn't even realize that they were doing it in the first place. It'd be very powerful.
And just to speak to the reality or the possibilities of something much greater than what is, when it comes to, let's for example, we say panic attacks, right? I had a panic attack when I was really in the deep work of doing Joe Dispenza's stuff, which you can, people might say it's not scientific or whatever, but it's, for me, I had a belief in my mind that, you know, there's panic attacks, that's all there is. But then I started experiencing love attacks, which is, it sounds so crazy, but it's, I'd be so filled up, my cup would be so filled up that I'd start to feel this, like these random attacks of love, where you just feel so full of bliss and so full of life. And even speaking to that as well, the process of compassion, which is to see yourself and others, I said it's more empathy, but compassion, which is to then take action from that, it requires long-term thinking. Compassion isn't a short-term reaction, it's a long-term response. And if we are always in reaction to our environment, which by definition means using our phones, because that's a reaction, they're unable to go through the long-term process, the thought process of compassion. When you let your thoughts unfurl and your mind unfurl, you start to go down a direction of seeing the things that you didn't see, seeing yourself reflected back in a mirror of what you did wrong or what you didn't do wrong, and so on and so on. That's where compassion comes from. And it's really to love your environment and love those around you. And I think this is really beautiful. And I wanted to ask a question around what you said when it comes to natural healing state. So if you could just expand that a bit, just rather natural healing state, because people just say, I'm alive or I'm stressed. What is a natural healing state? And like, what, how is that different from, you know, dysbiosis and illness and things like that?
Yeah, I think that if I looked at it just purely as a starting point in differentiating the stress response from the relaxation response just as a starting point. When you allow your body and your mind to go into a restful state, that is healing. When you're sleeping, you are healing. It's really interesting because there's been research that says certain states that we enter, trance states, states that we access when we do things like meditation or hypnosis or something else that's the quiet place that we go into, we actually get some of the most profound healing, brain and body, that we get even sometimes better than sleep, which is fantastic. Just to know we can be investing in our health, in our healing, just like we do when we pop some supplements or we go to the gym. We're doing some amazing healing work when we choose to switch on the relaxation response, letting go of tensions, just allowing ourselves to just be. One of the things that often is not talked about enough that I think we can just lean into a little bit, Luke, is around, well, what's actually the placebo effect? So we have this thing we have well documented where the body has the ability to create healing in response to a suggestion that we might be receiving medicine to heal us. And there's always going to be a certain percentage of the population or certain percentage of us that are going to respond to a placebo, a fake medicine, which can even happen with fake surgeries and other forms of suggestion that we have received, usually by a trusted authority figure, that tells us that this thing that we are consuming or having done is going to help us. And that positive suggestion from a trusted figure with a belief, something happens in the unconscious that believes that's possible, that facilitates healing. That's the mind-body connection working for us, but we're not spending a lot of time tapping into understanding what's actually producing that. We just assume that that's a part of what we need to do to make trials real with a, you know, controlled trial to see if the medicine actually works. But there's something going on there. Perhaps there's a little bit more into that we could look into to understand how do we actually enact deliberately the placebo effect. So there's just a couple of ways in which I think healing states can be enacted very naturally. But I think you might even have some other ideas about natural healing states, Luke. Did you have some additional thoughts on that?
No, I don't actually. I mean, when it comes to, oh, actually, no, I do. I was thinking in my mind, placebo, natural healing states. Mm-hmm. Yes, I do. The first thing for me would be mindfulness meditation. That's always one. The second thing would be ecstatic dancing. So there's been some studies done with dancing and specifically non-structured dancing. So freedom of expression, which I would call either five rhythms or ecstatic dancing. So back when I was in Sydney, we would often go to dancing events where you'd play music and everyone's all shy and less so in these places because they get used to it. And perhaps you've tried it yourself, maybe in other places like Bali and things like that do it. They have this environment where they put music on and you just start to let loose. And I remember this is my, speaking about my other awakening experience in 2018 or 19, one of the two, I went to one of these events and I remember at this point in time, I'd stopped drinking entirely and I'd been struggling with alcohol for a long time in the past and I really let it go. I just said, yep, not doing anymore. Read a book that really rewired my thoughts around alcohol and my relationship to it. It was a book called The Easy Way to Quit Alcohol by Alan Carr. And essentially, I guess my summary of it was creating an airtight argument around the pointlessness of drinking alcohol. And everyone has their own ways of doing it. But for me, I had a bad relationship with alcohol. So some of the things he spoke about was when alcohol, the environment in which we drink alcohol, how it can eventually become something we integrate into our life and how it kind of doesn't make sense that we have to have a drink here and a drink there. And anyways, long story short, I went to that journey. I ended up leaving alcohol behind, haven't drank since. Went to this environment and I'd been used to being in a state of drunkenness, you know, not being intoxicated, right? So being intoxicated in this environment, I went in there, I was completely sober. It was one of the first times I'd done this in a long time and it felt so awkward, so uncomfortable. And I said to myself, let's just try something. Let's just try for the next 1 hour. I'm just going to keep dancing. I'm not going to stop until I feel completely 100% free. I can close my eyes, I can do it privately, but I'm just going to do it for 1 hour. I was in this environment where there's about maybe 100 people there. So on the dance floor, and I'm just like closing my eyes, just like kind of moving like this, and I'm just like, this is so weird. Everyone's looking at me. I'm a weirdo. Like, what am I doing here? There's just all these weird people here. This is so strange. I'm just like kind of bobbing around, and I'm just like, 5 minutes passed. I'm like, this is stupid, but it's actually okay. I kind of like this. Then 15 minutes passed. We're like, I can't like this music. I was like, oh, wait a second. I'm losing my judgment around this. And then 30 minutes in, I'm like, open my eyes for every, like, you know, for a few seconds here and there. And I'm like moving my body and got the rhythm going. And then after about, it was about 40, 45 minutes, eyes were open. I felt completely free. I felt connected to everyone around me. I felt the music flowing through me. Whole thing. And it helped me to realize that movement, not just in a structured format, which is what we tend to do as humans, you know, yoga, which there is more like loose kind of interpretive yoga, but for the most part, it's structured. Dancing, hip-hop dancing, whatever it is, it's structured. You know, playing a game of tennis, it's structured. All these rules and things around it, which has its utility, I understand that. But for me, there's just such freedom in doing that. So I went down this journey of going to these events. I haven't been to one in a while, actually, but of just doing freedom dancing and just dancing in the way that I feel most expressive, like letting all of everything that I have inside of me let loose. And then you're in an environment of people doing that, it becomes normal. Like, you just start to dance freely, and then you have no qualms dancing in public in front of everyone when everyone's looking. And that's kind of where it turned into. So that's one thing for me. So meditation, unrestricted movement. And another thing as well would be have a consistent sleep schedule. I mean, I know that you mentioned this before, but for me, I'm very sensitive to, and it's so interesting, right? So you have, when you become more and more dysregulated, the things that used to not affect you would affect you more than what it usually would. So if you're someone that's sensitive to going to bed at different times, and you start to have sleep onset or sleep maintenance insomnia, hard time falling asleep or hard time staying asleep, you realize the more you're dysregulated, the more that happens. Whereas if you're regulated, you can kind of go to bed at different times and your body just kind of naturally adjusts really quickly. But for me, when I'm feeling dysregulated, which is, I'd say every couple of weeks when it's a stressful thing happening at work, by dysregulated, I mean I go into a place of like anxious and stressed and whatever. For me, it's always meditation. I look at meditation to see myself, what am I doing with meditation? It's movement, so it's freedom of expression in the body. If I'm doing that, or if I'm in Sydney, or even just at home here, sometimes I do it once a few weeks ago, actually. Or sleep, just getting back to a routine, a schedule. Like, I just need to go to bed the same time, do the same thing. Those are the three main things for me.
Yeah, I love that. And it's. I think it's important that people understand that there is, each of those things will give you a different piece to the puzzle for your wellness, and that you've learned over time what you need to be doing consistently in order for it to work and to feel the best that you feel. So I certainly encourage everyone to go on their own quest or journey of trying to find the right combination for them, to find what it is that allows the healing states to occur, to allow you to feel well. And it's really important, we have to trust, when a lot of those things take time to see results or to see shifts and changes happen, we have to be patient with that process. That is a hugely important part of it. We have to trust that even if we don't feel some revolutionary shift or that state of bliss straight away, that there is an accumulative benefit. You know, your choice to invest that 5-10 minutes of meditation, that half an hour of exercise, sacrificing something else so that you can get decent sleep, that it, over time, it continues to benefit yourselves. If we have the privilege and opportunity to do regular testing to know what's going on in our bloods, in our certain levels, in our cells, in our telomeres, we have the ability to do that, but not everyone has that accessible to get that constant evidence of shift and change and benefit. We have to trust that we are making the investment for a good reason and that those benefits will show themselves over time. And I think if there is, sometimes we also need to get a little extra help and support to deal with some other things that may be going on that might be blocking our healing and our recovery, especially if we're doing a lot of the right things and still not getting traction, there may be something else getting in the way, which is sometimes where people might come to a practitioner to go into a deeper place to understand what might also be happening within the mind or trapped in the body. You know, you mentioned breath work. Breath work helps people move trapped and stored emotions out of the body. that sometimes can be important to facilitate healing. We can do that with other types of techniques. Hypnosis, timeline therapy, other things too can be really helpful to just move out of the system something that may be keeping it trapped in a state of disease or suffering. And that is also an important part for some people in their journey.
And speaking of which, that's a nice segue. So for your work and for the things that you do, if someone wants to see you and do work with you and to go on that journey, the healing journey as we call it, where can they find you and how can they reach out to you?
Yeah, for sure. The people are welcome to connect with me for one-on-one work. MiriamHenker.com is the easiest place to find me. I also run retreats where people get to have an immersive experience of working with their mind-body connection and trying different mind-body practices in beautiful places in the world. So if you're interested in something that's more immersive, then check out quantumretreats.com.au. And if you're also interested in more about the mind-body medicine and the connection between the mind-body and where that can take you, have a look at themainspringmethod.com.au, where that's specifically about mind-body medicine.
Beautiful. Well, thanks so much for joining and coming on. Is there any final thoughts or anything you wanted to leave the listeners?
Oh, look, I just want people to know that in the journey of finding health and healing, there's no one right way. There are many paths to wellness, and just keep searching until you find the right formula for you. That's really my final thought, Luke. And I really appreciate you sharing your journey and your stories with me. You've certainly been on an amazing journey and have amazing wisdom to share with people. So thank you for
Thank you so much.